Welcome to the first panel session, Digital Information and Social Media Challenge for Family Lawyers of Different Generations. When William and I started to put together the topics for what was Kyiv 2020, never did we think that this panel would be so apt. It was completely pre-pandemic. By showing my age, if I go back to the old days when I started in practice, there were no emails. We hardly had a mobile telephone. Our days were faxes arriving and letters in our inbox in the morning, and then the world imploded with Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all different means of communications, which some might say was the worst thing to happen for family lawyers when the temperatures are high, when the fuses go. We've all seen the impact, both positive and negative, of all of those messages that are sent in haste. So let me introduce you to the panel. Our first panelist is Alison Edmondson. She's a partner in SKO in Edinburgh in Scotland. So she will be looking at things from a Scottish perspective and focusing on two key elements which have changed recently in the Scottish system. Alison's key interests are in business interests, pensions, taxation, and inherited wealth. But she also has an interest in cases where one party has lost capacity, which is approaching things from a different angle. Alison is a mediator, a collaborative lawyer, and also an arbitrator, and works both in the Court of Session, and I love the name, the Sheriff Court as well, because it makes me think of the Wild West. Next, we have Sylvia Katzenmeier. Sylvia and I joined the IFL together 10 years ago. We went to our first conference in Strasbourg together, where in those days we were the first green dots. So when you go to your first conference, you are singled out by a dot on your name badge. So we were green dots together. Sylvia works in Sarsbrücken, in fact, in Germany, and covers all aspects of family law, but has a particular interest in French family law and Luxembourg family law. She's going to look at things for us from a German perspective, looking at social media and children, our children's use of social media, which is very interesting for those of us with children, client acquisition from a German point of view on social media. Then we will turn to Charlotte Boutu-Cardo, who joins us from Paris. She is a partner and co-founder of CBBC law firm in Paris. Charlotte has also got 20 years of experience in high net worth cases, always with an international element, and she has a particular interest in tax and trusts and foundation issues. Charlotte listens to her clients very carefully to make sure she understands their needs and their priorities. She is also a collaborative trained lawyer, and she and I have shared many collaborative law platforms over the years in different cities. Charlotte's going to look at social media from a French perspective for us, but also look at it from the ethical rules point of view, as well as the limits and the use at court. And then we'll finish off with James Stewart, who'll be known to many of you. He's a partner at Penningtons Manches Cooper in London. James has been an IFL fellow and held many positions over the years. And he's best known for what we in the profession know as the Blue Book, which in fact was published. The latest edition was published this year. And he's promised me a copy will arrive in the post very soon. And it's a market leading guide on all aspects of international family law. James, as you know, is a big fan of social media. He's very active on LinkedIn and Clubhouse. He's going to look for us at the benefits, but also the shortfalls of social media. So I will start by handing over to Alison. Each panelist is going to speak for 15 minutes. Please make sure that you are on mute. Each panelist will then hand over directly to the next panelist. Please use the Q&A button for questions, which we will take at the end. There's time for questions at the end. And then between each session, there will be enough time to go and grab another cup of tea or a can of Coke or whatever it is to help you through the morning. So without further ado, I hand over to Alison.
Thanks very much, Suzanne. Give me a moment, I'll try and get my screen share up. So hopefully you can see that. Could one of the panelists I can see just let me know whether you can actually see my slideshow? Yeah, good stuff. Super. So as Suzanne says, we're looking at digital information and social media from a lawyer's perspective. So obviously that is an absolutely vast topic. So what I've done is just pick out a couple of things where I think that the approach in Scotland is, I suppose that we've done something a bit different recently. There's something a little bit innovative that might be interesting to hear about from our other jurisdictions who might be thinking of doing something similar. So this is one of my pet projects is law reform. So these are recent Scottish law reforms. So there's two statutes in particular that I'd like to talk about. The Abusive Behaviour and Sexual Harm Scotland Act, which is the 2016 legislation, and the Domestic Abuse Scotland Act 2018. So if we take the first of these first, 2016 Act came from a fairly politically active campaign to criminalise the use of digital technology sharing sexual images of a person publicly, so with the particular intention to cause humiliation or hurt. So what you would hear colloquially and see in the media as revenge porn. So the focus of this quite short piece of legislation is on revenge porn. I've set out the specifics of the Act in the next three slides. At its simplest, it makes revenge porn a criminal offence. So if a person discloses or threatens to disclose a picture or a video of another person in an intimate situation, intending to cause fear, alarm or distress, or reckless as to whether fear, alarm and distress might be caused, then that's a criminal offence. There are a couple of qualifications. One of them is the second thing on that slide there, which is that if the person has consented to that image already being in the public domain, then it's not an offence to reshare it. The potential harm and suffering that might be caused is specifically clarified as including psychological harm. So that broadens us out from maybe a more traditional understanding of domestic abuse to understand the full impact that these actions can have. The maximum sentence in Scotland for committing the offence is 5 years or a fine or both. So that's quite a significant sentence of imprisonment. So I have before I come on for case study, a couple of thoughts I had just about the political background for the bill and the conversation that we as a jurisdiction had around it before we brought this legislation in. So one of the objections to the criminal offence was that some of this conduct is already criminal. You don't need a specific law to govern this when you've already got your criminal code that would deal with most of these offences by just expanding other ones or being a bit more creative about using the law we already have. And it was a cross-party consensus within the Scottish Parliament that that wasn't enough, that actually the drafting of the new law provided an opportunity to set out the parameters of behaviour that counts as criminal in this sphere, and that just using old law and trying to sort of transport it into the digital sphere was inadequate in a deterrence sense. One of the purposes of the law is to communicate what is acceptable behaviour and what's not. And one of the significant policy drivers behind this piece of legislation was sending a message that the use of digital technology in this way is harmful and is therefore not permitted socially. So I will come on to the case study. And this is based on real life. So a client, Jim, discovering that his wife has been having an affair after finding intimate videos and photos sent to her by another man. It's not terribly difficult to imagine. In the photos, the wife's boyfriend, Andrew, is visible in the photos. Andrew appears in an intimate image, and Jim's got the videos because they were on a shared computer. What if Jim and his wife have an argument and he shouts at her that she better be careful or those will go viral? You can imagine they might well have a blazing row following the discovery of the adultery and such a definite form of evidence of it. But if you recall what was on the previous slides, he's making a threat to disclose there. And if he's even so much as reckless as to the intention that his actions might have, the effect it might have on Andrew or the wife, then yes, he's at risk of being prosecuted for a criminal offence. Second scenario, your client's Jim and he wants to send you that evidence so you can keep it on file as evidence of adultery. So I'm pretty clear that at the point at which he sends it to you, it's covered by legal professional privilege in terms of Scots law. Then he tells you he wants you to lodge it at court. On the face of this legislation, that's disclosing it. I mean, that's going to be into the public domain. It's going to go through the hands of the court clerks, and there is no defence
to this offence because you're doing it in the course of a court action. The third scenario, it would be if Jim posted these images on his own social media, and I'm pretty clear that is the criminal offence, and that's the actual harm that this legislation was targeted at. So the word of advice here would just be that if you hail from a jurisdiction where you're contemplating legislation of this nature, don't leave it to the criminal lawyers. You need family lawyers to have actually run some case studies about the exact impact and the potential unintended consequences of this kind of offence, because we certainly are finding that whilst it might work quite well in a criminal context, not all of the consequences have been properly thought through in the context of a family law case. So that was a quick canter through our 2016 legislation, and I'm going to come on to the 2018 legislation. So we've got a new offence here of engaging in an abusive course of conduct against a current or former partner. So that can include physical violence, threat, psychological abuse, and emotional abuse. And that's, for us, that's a new approach because it reflects our collective increased understanding of the nature of domestic abuse. It expands it well beyond the old definition of violence into that much more intimate partner abuse, which can be over a protracted period. And it allows that course of conduct to be seen as one whole. So we don't end up in a situation where the complainer simply has to prove one small instance and that doesn't have serious consequences for the perpetrator. You can look at the whole and it's a much more holistic view. The behaviour is described in quite an innovative way, I think. So behaviour that has as its purpose, so there is a real intentionality here, the effect of making the partner dependent on or subordinate to the abuser, isolating the partner, controlling, monitoring day-to-day activity, restricting freedom of action, causing fear, humiliation, degrading, punishing, all the things that would be inevitably part of the more modern, more detailed understanding of domestic abuse. So I've picked this up as having particular pertinence in the context of digital technology, because technology has opened up lots of new ways that perpetrators can actually carry out these types of behaviour, but also, interestingly, ways in which they can be recorded and proven. And that's important for us, I should probably explain, in a Scottish context, we have to have corroboration of all facts in order to get a criminal prosecution. And so we're always looking for two sources of evidence minimum for every single fact. And if you've got digital records of abuse, that might assist sometimes when domestic abuse by its very nature often hasn't been witnessed. So I wanted just to pick up on some specific ways in which domestic abuse is being perpetrated using digital technology, just things that we might want to have a bit more on our radar and things that in Scotland now would be covered by this criminal offence. So I picked out use of messages, social media privacy settings, and the ability to kind of follow somebody's activities using their social media. Online gaming gives a whole portal into a person's world, and spyware, surveillance and safety. I'm sure we've all had cases where somebody's come into your office and they seem to know an awful lot about their partner's email correspondence to an extent that makes you just wonder where the source of that information has come from. Lots of different apps that are constantly evolving, and I don't know about anybody else, I simply cannot keep up. And then the one I just want to use a couple of my last remaining minutes to talk about was the Internet of Things and home automation. Because there's a huge amount of literature developing quite recently about the way in which increasing automation of the home is giving a way of, I suppose, exercising that control and abuse that we were talking about. So whether that's just by turning lights on and off when somebody's not there, adjusting the temperature to uncomfortable levels, playing unwanted music, adjusting the volume, triggering home evasion and smoke alarms. I've had quite a few cases where people are monitoring activity in the home using a remote camera doorbell that they can log into the security system and see who's coming and going from a home they no longer live in. Smart locks can be controlled. I've had an instance of somebody being locked out their house by their former partner, despite the fact that they were no longer living together. And I had a case recently where the wife discovered her husband's adultery because the girlfriend had weighed herself on the household scales and they were synced to the wife's Fitbit. And that's how she discovered that he was having an affair. So these are all, I suppose, things that impact on our practice that we're going to see greater development in them. And we're going to be asked for advice by our clients. And I certainly feel much more comfortable talking about the terms of the 2016 Act and the 2018 Act than I do giving advice about how you apply security settings to your home automation devices. So I've put a few of the practical tips on the final slide I've given you. That is categorically not my advice. That came from Safer Lives. I don't know, it, certainly within our jurisdiction, saferlives.org.uk gives the source material that a lot of the domestic abuse charities, the education outfits and the refuges, they use Safer Lives. So if you do want more detail about any of the practical advice, I would definitely recommend Safer Lives as a good website to explore. So that brings me to the end of what I've tried to rattle through. And I'd be happy to take questions. I think, Suzanne, you wanted to take questions at the end of the panel.
We can do, but you've got 2 minutes left. So Derek has just a quick question. Is there any requirement that the perpetrator or victim or both have to be resident in Scotland for the purposes of the revenge porn?
So I would defer to a criminal lawyer on criminal jurisdiction, but at its simplest, it's where the crime is committed. Now that opens up a whole world of jurisdictional pain, but it particularly in the context of this offence, it's where the threat is made or tends to be where the person is when they make the disclosure. The Scottish police will deal with it. So if you've got somebody at a computer in Edinburgh making the disclosure, rather than, we wouldn't expect that we could expand the boundaries of our jurisdiction.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Thank you for that, Alison. So we will hand over to Sylvia. I'm not going to say the famous words, but you're on mute.
Okay. Can you hear me?
I can now perfectly.
Yes. Thank you. Yes. Good morning, everybody from Germany. I'm happy to speak to you today. In my presentation, I have focused on the topic social media and children, use of postings on social media as evidence, and contact with clients on social media. I would first like to explain a ruling by the Frankfurt Higher Regional Court that dealt with the question of whether parents are allowed to give their children their own smartphone with free internet access. This is a question that has actually been discussed recently in our family law proceedings. What was the case about? A married couple, A, the father, and B, the mother, had been living apart since July 2017. They have a common daughter, D, who is 8 years old. A and B have discussed with which parent D should have her habitual residence. At that time, she was living mainly with the mother. The mother has then filed an application for transfer of the right to determine D's place of residence at the Bad Hersfeld Family Court, which was the first instance court. During her hearing with the judge and the GAL, Dee mentioned to the competent judge that she has free access to the internet in the household of the mother B via the mother's computer and tablet, but especially via her own smartphone. The competent judge was of the opinion that B's, the daughter's, well-being is endangered by the free access to the internet. So then the court has decided as a result, and the judge transferred the right of residence to the mother B, but the judge ordered also ex officio to establish fixed rules regarding the daughter's media consumption, especially regarding TV, computer, game console, and tablet, especially regarding the times and the content. Also, the court ordered the mother to inform the court about the set rules within a period of 2 months. Furthermore, The mother was forbidden to provide her daughter with her own smartphone until she is 12 years old. At this time, she was 8 years old. The court justified these measures on the ground that the use of internet and platforms such as YouTube leads to the risk that B has access to content that is not appropriate for her age and which could harm her development. The court also feared that the child could be exposed to cyberbullying. B has appealed against this decision to the Frankfurt Higher Regional Court. The Frankfurt Higher Regional Court, which was responsible for the appeal, allowed the appeal in full and gave the following reasons for this. The court said that it is not permissible to impose measures ex officio just because it becomes known in proceedings that a child has free access to the internet. They said that the court may only take measures ex officio if there are concrete indications that a child is at risk from the free use of social media or internet. For example, if the child regularly surfs on sites with pornographic contents. And they said, according to Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights, it is not permissible to prescribe a certain lifestyle to the parents of a child. State intervention is only possible if the best interest of the child specifically require it, and state intervention is not possible from the point of view of an ideal exercise of custody. That will say parents have not to be ideal parents. It is not justified to judge a possible damage by free use of the internet differently than watching harmful contents on television, consumption of junk food, or neglect of personal hygiene. So state intervention is therefore only possible in the case of concrete evidence of damage caused by this. So the conclusion of the court was, the provision of a smartphone does not justify the assumption that the parents are harming their child through free internet access. Another topic is the problem when children are influencers. We have a lot of children who are influencers, and that's a big market actually. As an example, we have the 8-year-old Ryan. I don't know if you know him, who has 9.4 million followers on his internet blog on Ryan's Toy Review, and he generates sales of 22 million in 2018. Influencers are people who reach a large number of people on the internet with their content, offer an insight into their lives, and directly or indirectly promote a product. In the target group of the 19 years old, 50% buy a product because it was recommended by an influencer. So many adults only buy a product because it was recommended by an influencer. It is generally accepted in the case law of the German courts that the publication of photographs or films is not a matter of general everyday life that can be decided by one parent alone, but a matter of general importance for the children on which the parents must agree, especially if the publication takes place in social networks or on a website that serves commercial purposes. In a landmark decision, the courts have ruled that in the event of a conflict between parents, the sole decision-making authority to publish photos or videos of the child on social media must be given to the parent who objects. Another problem concerning the monitoring power and parental responsibility is the digital communication of the child. And we have this discussion actually often in proceedings in Germany. Among other things, it is discussed whether parents are entitled to monitor the digital communication of their children, for example, by using a spy app. According to the case law of the German courts, this is not allowed because the privacy of the child has to be respected. Parents are only allowed to monitor the public posts of their children, for example, on their public profiles on Facebook and Instagram, but not their private conversations via email, WhatsApp, Facebook, and Messenger. According to the German family law, the child must be granted a space of freedom that is limited by the parent's duty and authority to supervise. It follows that parents may only supervise their children's private communication via social media if there are concrete indications that the communication endangers the child's well-being. Now that I have highlighted some aspects regarding the issue of children and social media, we come to another issue regarding social media, namely to what extent I'm allowed to use content from social media as evidence in a trial. That will be a problem that we have often in practice. So the question is, may I use information I have collected on social media for the client? It's always the question, data protection versus legitimate interest. There is a landmark decision on this from the Brandenburg Family Court in 2017. I have made a PowerPoint presentation. You can see it, I think, in the online conference. So you can see the concrete decision of the Brandenburg Family Court. In this case, decided by the Brandenburg Family Court, divorced spouses disputed the payment of postmarital spousal support. As you know, perhaps in Germany, it is always possible to get a postmarital spousal support after the divorce. The husband argued that his wife's claim to maintenance had been forfeited because she had been living with a new partner for more than 2 years in a stable relationship. The wife normally disputed this. The husband then submitted a photo of the wife and her partner that she had published on Facebook, both together arm in arm, and it showed her and her partner in an unambiguous pose. In addition, under the photo was the sentence, "already heavy for 3 years." The court was of the opinion that the husband was allowed to use the photo as evidence in the trial since the wife had posted the photo publicly on her Facebook page. It's another thing if you ask a friend to make a friend request and then get this information, but she has publicly published this photo and so he could use it. So if you represent parties in divorce cases, the first thing you should do is tell them to check their privacy settings in social networks, because this can really be a problem. Another point is the acquisition via social media. So in Germany, the permissibility of acquiring clients is regulated by the Federal Lawyers Act. I think this will be similar in other countries. And in Germany, advertising for a lawyer is only permissible for attorneys to the extent that it provides factual information in form and content about a professional activity and is not directed at the placement of an order in an individual case. The only restriction is that the internet presence must correspond to the dignified appearance of a lawyer. For example, you can't make an advertising and saying, "I'm the best lawyer in the world. I can beat any opponent. Any other lawyer is afraid of me." That's not allowed. So I will come, and I think I am good at my time, to my last point. So the question is, should I connect with clients on social media? My personal opinion is on Crossing and LinkedIn, yes, because these are professional sites, but not never on Facebook and Instagram. Partly because it's not a secure way to communicate with clients, and partly because you might not want to give clients too much insight into your private life. This can also be problematic because you are not friends, you are lawyer and client. So that was a quick overview of different problems concerning social media. I hope I was able to address some practical issues. And finally, I wish the conference continued success and hope that we will meet again soon in a face-to-face event. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sylvia. I'm just going to jump in with one question from Lucky Hoy just before we pass over to Charlotte. So Sylvia, is it not the duty of parents to determine the best interest of the child? To not permit the parent to look at conversations with friends will lead to exposure to content that may be very harmful.
No, the courts are saying no, because they are saying the child has also a right of privacy. You can't check as a parent every correspondence of your child with another children, only if you have some signs that there is really a dangerful correspondence, perhaps with an older man or something like this. But generally, you can't survive all communication of your children.
Okay, thank you very much. For those of us who do check our children's mobile phones, that's interesting. Thank you very much. There may be some people in London who will remember when you refer to the what we're allowed to do from a marketing point of view. I think about 15 years, there was a very interesting campaign by a family law firm here who put posters in the underground trying to advertise for new clients in not a particularly palatable way. So that was taken down very, very quickly. Thank you very much, Sylvia. We're now going to travel to Paris in France, and I will hand over to Charlotte.
Hello, so good morning to everyone from Paris. Very sad not to see you, at least in person. So the French perspective on the use of social media and digital information is pretty similar, I think, to all the people who have spoken in this panel, because it has radically changed family lawyers' day-to-day practice, and I think this is around the globe. So I have provided a paper. I'm not going to exactly mirror the paper, otherwise it would not be funny. And I'm just going to touch on a few points of it. So the first point is, of course, the use of social media and digital information has changed our practice as family lawyers, because we see the influence of it in court as evidence. Clients use social media, of course, more and more, and we must be careful with it, because the court are actually taking this into account and sometimes sanctioning the client very harshly for practice which would appear to most of us maybe acceptable. And as Suzanne said, you know, something you would do. But we have clients, for example, if they are famous actress or model, and they have an Instagram account with many, many followers, and then they put pictures of them on holiday with their minor children, and you can see their face on it. And court would not appreciate this, because they would say, listen, this is the right of privacy of the child. You should not put a picture of your child on a social media, especially if you have many, many followers. So again, it would depend if you have a client with maybe 5 followers, and if you have a client with 3,000 or 10,000 followers, of course, it has not got the same impact. Social media and digital information also provides very useful information in relation to adultery, for example. We all know this, and you often find a screenshot of the husband or wife's smartphone with wonderful and love words to a mistress or a lover, which are then produced in court to say, well, listen, my husband or my wife obviously has an affair. And French law in this respect is considering that it is fine. You can probably use that evidence. Interestingly enough, I had a case where one of my clients was employed by a very big company, and the company provided iPads to have very confidential information sent to the director of the company. And because this information was so confidential, the kind of iPad changed secret password almost every 2 weeks so that no one could access to them. And the secret password was sent to the director so that they could access this personal and very confidential information of the company. And what about if your secret password, if you're a director, is written on a piece of paper, because of course, otherwise you forget about it, and your husband finds that secret password, which is not supposed to have, quite obviously, and use the information provided on the iPad. Even worse, if he's copying this information and sending them to a non-confidential and secure iPad. And then the French court in that situation thought that there was no proof of a violation of confidentiality, because if the client, e.g. the director, did not want this information to be shared, in that case, she would have had to hide the password more securely. Finally, please just note that, for example, in the Johnny Hallyday case, they were using geo-tracking information to decide whether he has been residing actually in France or in the US. So all this is kind of quite worrying, because the reality is, as we all know, there is nothing we can hide anymore. Just touching about what Sylvia said, and I find this very interesting, I have more and more parents disagreeing precisely on what type of social media their child is supposed to access. And without wanting to be polemical, the TikTok application was something which was very worrying for a lot of parents. And equally, they did not have a unanimous view on whether TikTok should be on their child's phone or used. And is it really now the new role of family judges to be deciding whether a child should have access to TikTok? And equally, where is the child privacy when we know that actually on internet you have much more damaging information than just simply walking in the street, because people are disguising who they are and real information about them. So we all know this, the net is actually... Okay. A huge danger. And so what is the relation of parents to this? On the last note on this, interestingly enough, precisely social media has also changed the way corporate and business commercial law in France looks at children. Because actually children are often very good at social media. They are actually sometimes making money out of it. And so it has changed their status in commercial law, because they're actually becoming businessmen on social media much more than we are. And I'm saying this, of course, except for James and Susan, who are very good with it. But the point is, social media is a huge change for us, not only as family lawyers, admissible evidence, and the fact that it's becoming more and more difficult to hide anything, but also because it's changing the status of minority and children whilst having this huge risk associated to it. So I'm not gonna go, because I'm very wary to keep my minutes for James. So I'm not gonna go through the point of the French bar ethical code. This is all in my paper, if that is of any interest to you. What I'd like to simply quickly touch on is the way we have communicated, the way us lawyers are now communicating with our client. Now, as a lawyer, I will find that my important client are actually never using emails almost anymore to get in touch with me, but they're using WhatsApp because they find that it's going to be easier to access me wherever, however, and an email is just going to be lost in the trail of email when, if they use WhatsApp, they have a chance I read their message faster. The problem with that is, first of all, it has changed our relationship to client, because strangely enough, again for us, there are no limits between private and work life. It's all on how personal WhatsApp alongside with our children asking us at what time we eat in the evening. The second point is that we also have a problem talking about WhatsApp. What about privilege? What about confidentiality of information? And what we find, and I find this quite ironic, is that now in France, at least, a lot of criminal lawyers, to avoid information being so easily accessible or hacked, are using Signal. Signals as a new way to deal with your client, but also Signal as some terrorist will use. So everyone is trying to find a way to secure and privilege the conversation they have with their client in a situation where the more we are going to use WhatsApp, the more we are going to use Zoom meetings, the less confidentiality we can provide for our client. And this is becoming very problematic in a situation where, alongside with that, your rules of confidentiality for you, for example, Suzanne or even Alison, are probably not my rules of confidentiality. So we're in a kind of big wild world with rules which are not harmonized on confidentiality and privilege. And yet we're using more and more this kind of social media and new ways of communicating with clients without being able to secure the confidentiality of our information. And so I find this for lawyers very problematic. We have the same difficulty with storing on iCloud, for example, data. How are we protecting our client from hackers? But now a 12-year-old child can be a hacker. So how are we creating security for our client in the light of this social media and new technology? So I hope I have kept my timing all right.
In fact, you have enough time to talk about the Paris Bar and the ethics as well, Charlotte. You've done so well.
I'm expecting some kind of WhatsApp little message from you. So, social media, a last point, has also triggered another question for us, and that is us, especially in France, because unlike, for example, in the UK and in the US, I have forbidden as a lawyer normally to give the name of my clients. So I cannot put on my website, I've advised the very famous Susan Todd and James Stewart for their absolutely glamorous family story. This was a joke, by the way. So I cannot do that. I cannot give the name of my client, and I cannot make advertising either. I cannot go on the newspaper and say, hello, I'm a family lawyer, I'm absolutely great, come and consult me. But the reality is, with social media, everyone is starting to do that. For a start, the first question we all had, and I'm sure you also had it, is what do you do when you've got a LinkedIn account? Do you only put your other professional bodies, or do you accept your clients who want to become friends with you on LinkedIn? And then, first of all, you know, you have the first issue there. Are you promoting yourself as a lawyer on LinkedIn, and then therefore promoting yourself to your client because they're also on LinkedIn? The second point is, normally the Paris bar, and I'm sure most of the bar, would want you to consult them before you give, for example, an interview, before you speak to the press, because of course, as a lawyer, you should always keep some kind of deontological approach to the way you speak to others, especially in public. But likewise, when you are going to put a post on LinkedIn, if you are a very, very famous lawyer with many LinkedIn friends or WhatsApp friends or whatever, in that case, you know, your approach is no longer tailored by a preliminary information to your bar, and you are simply, you know, posting and doing things very rapidly whilst you're on the train without paying much attention. And this sometimes is also a problem. So the Paris bar is always reminding his lawyer that they should be quite careful and always respect with the essential principle of our profession. But we always have this problem. We have more and more, and I'm sure you have the same, some kind of trashing of lawyers on, for example, LinkedIn. Recently, for example, we had in Paris a difficulty because one lawyer was accused by our press article to be acting very unprofessionally, shall we say, towards his assistant. And this was relayed on all social media. So not only was it published in the press, but it went as a kind of zoom
viral
fire on all social media. And that's becoming a problem, because is that a freedom of expression? Once you have something like this, which is relayed so heavily on every possible social media, and which only result from the version or the appreciation of one side or one party, is that really fair to have such trashing? And that's complicated, because I think we can all have this. I have the wife of one of my longest clients, and I'm very sad about it, who sometimes find it funny to post things when I do something. She never does it negatively. She never does it in a derogatory way, but she always kind of posts a little comment when I give a conference. I'm probably going to have a little comment after this one, or when I write an article. What do we do with this? Is this something which we have to react to? Do we have to ignore it? And what about if people become more aggressive? How do you gag this? It is really complicated. And I think for all of us, it's going to become real issues that we will have to deal with.
So I think so. We call them in England keyboard warriors, people who are very happy to hide behind a keyboard and say things on social media that they would not be willing to say to people's face. Yeah. Thank you very much, Charlotte. That was fantastic. And now we're going to whiz back to London and pass over to James.
Well, Suzanne and everyone else, thank you for having me on today. A lot of the problems and issues described by Charlotte and Sylvie in particular, I think are common to many jurisdictions. Just turning to Sylvia's point, I really do think it's important to differentiate between different types of social media and differentiate between the personal and the professional. Like, I certainly regard Facebook as personal, and other platforms such as LinkedIn, and indeed even Instagram can be more professional. Ali, I think I had a couple of slides which I'm going to talk to.
As if by magic.
Thank you so much. Just to the next one. Number two? This is a picture actually of the Blue Book, which is one of the reasons why I've been so active on LinkedIn recently. And all that I want to say in relation to that is it's just been published. And I've been publicizing it fairly heavily. And that is the one of the great things about social media. It enables you to get a message across to a wide variety of people. Can we go on to the next slide, Ali, please? We've heard a lot about social media and client abuses of social media and the like. And we're very cognizant of the need to protect children and the need to educate our clients on the use of social media. But actually, we've all been operating around lockdown, and those of us who do not advertise have been denied the possibility to attend and speak at conferences, to have lunch with contacts and the like. So in a way, social media, I think since lockdown, has been a godsend, and it enables us to get our message out there, and to, more importantly, we're all in this in family law as a business, as well as, you know, for the love of it. It enables us to generate clients and to protect our pipeline of work. But use of social media has to be effective. And I've just made a couple of points in that slide. You know, social media enables you to connect with new people who need your services. That's absolutely clear. And we can all take advantage of the huge spike in interest, the huge spike in usage of social media over the last few months. I mentioned the point that social media is a great substitute for traditional advertisements. In fact, it's more than a substitute in France and in Germany, where you don't seem to be able to advertise. Also, social media enables you to market your unique selling point. I've noticed some very effective social lawyers who have used social media to market, to highlight their expertise in the fields of surrogacy, for example, and the like. But it's really important to ensure that your social media usage is properly targeted. Do you know, LinkedIn is great, and I've got over 20,000 followers on LinkedIn. It's great in terms of sharing information, sharing articles, etc. But they need to be properly placed. They need to be interesting. They need to be interesting, and they need to be relevant. So, do you know, LinkedIn is great. It's great for maintaining a profile, and it has an international reach. Over the course of the lockdown, this is, I actually disagree with Sylvia in relation to Instagram, because Instagram's provided a great profile, Insta Live, for quite a lot of knowledge sharing and other engagements between the lawyer and the lawyer's contacts. And I know Instagram is quite difficult because it's a program that conflates the personal and the business. One has to be careful in terms of one's use of Instagram, but I do think Insta Live is a good tool for lawyers. TikTok was mentioned. Now, I personally can't get my head around TikTok, but one of LA's leading family lawyers, Kelly Chan, is on TikTok constantly, and she runs TikTok reels on a almost daily basis. And yes, she does do it to music and the like. But, you know, when you meet Kelly outside of TikTok, she is a very serious and good family lawyer. And she seems to maintain her business pipeline as a lot, you know, as a result of her TikTok and other activity. So maybe we don't dismiss it. I don't think it's right for the UK, but it seems to be acceptable in America. I do mention Clubhouse here. Clubhouse is a new audio platform which has really taken off in the last couple of months, and which allows you to engage with a global membership. So the bottom line is, social media usage for lawyers does enable you to get your face out there in lockdown and underline your particular areas of expertise. At the risk of stating the obvious, in LinkedIn and in other forms, create an all-star profile. You know, make sure your profile is up to date. It'll have lots of benefits, including improving your search engine optimization. That may be particularly beneficial in France and in Germany. But I have to say, you must be authentic when you post. Otherwise, it's going to be another boring legal post who wants to read something which has been taken out of the Law Society Gazette or something. Do you know, don't be turgid, be interesting and be authentic. And again, the whole effectiveness of your social media strategy can be monitored by Google Analytics. It can be monitored by your PA or your office, in determining where your referrals are coming from. What I find with social media is it's quite unusual to get a direct referral from somebody on LinkedIn, but people use it as a secondary source of referral. Can we go to the next page, please? Now, this is an example of a social media and knowledge sharing. Quite a number of IFL fellows have got together and set up a club on Clubhouse. And for example, we have a 5 o'clock chat on international family law topics every Sunday night. on a different subject of international family law. You see there last week's prenuptial agreements, and a couple of weeks' time we'll be talking about religious divorce. You know, that has been very successful. These talks are open to anyone with an interest in international family law, provided they're a member of Clubhouse, which is quite difficult to get into at the moment, but it's opening up. And I actually think Clubhouse, which is a unusual platform, it's an audio platform, which means you can kind of join in a discussion or even give a discussion in your pajamas and puffing away in your vape or whatever, nobody will notice. But it's very effective. In our first couple of Sunday afternoon chats, we've had over 100 attendees, so it's been successful. And I actually believe that social media is a brilliant way of knowledge sharing and disseminating details of your expertise. The middle bit is, I don't know if you know her, Lauren Nasser, who's very active as the family lawyer on Instagram, hosts a weekly Insta Live slot. Again, that's a good example of social media being used very effectively by lawyers to get their name out there and to bring clients in. And Laura, for her work on Instagram, actually was named Family Law Commentator of the Year. You know, so it really did propel her from a associate solicitor in Guildford to somebody who was exceptionally well known amongst the family law community. So I think knowledge sharing and profile raising activities are just there for the taking in social media, and lawyers have to be quite well aware of that. Can we go on to the next slide, please? Yes, there are pitfalls. There are pitfalls, but we're all adults and we're all bright. And we need to be aware of privacy concerns. Sylvia mentioned looking at your settings. And clients looking at their settings. I think lawyers need to look at privacy settings as well, because you know, access to location and personal information can be damaging for the lawyer as well as the client. We're family lawyers. We're often in high conflict situation. We need to look after ourselves, and again. Going on your social media, you have to be careful. You have to exercise discretion. Removing information is often terribly difficult. And Charlotte mentioned the naming of clients. Well, we can't name clients in social media in England, unless something has been publicly reported and we have the client's consent to do so. So we have a duty of confidentiality. And I have to say, you need to be very, very careful with that duty of confidentiality. I've seen some English lawyers who are talking about individual cases and hearings and so on and so forth that may have happened that day. You need to be very careful to say, not to say anything which could either directly or even indirectly kind of point towards a particular client. And at the risk of stating the obvious, one misplaced comment can impact on your reputation. You know, one stupid thing, one stupid post, whether it's about cardigans or otherwise, can come back to bite you in the bottom. So we all need to be careful. We all need to be careful. Can we just go to the next? Thank you so much. Obviously, we've heard a lot about children. And the one thing that bothers me about a lot of American lawyers on social media is that they are often producing photographs of their family. They're conflating the personal and the business, the personal and the professional. And all that I would say is that, you know, if we are saying to our clients not to share details of and not to post photographs of their children, certainly without the other parent's consent, is it really right that we should post photographs of our children and LinkedIn and or not LinkedIn, but Instagram and TikTok and so on and so forth? You know, children do have the right to privacy, and that must be respected. Now, another thing is, some of you will be horrified if you go in some of the American lawyers' chat rooms on Clubhouse. In England, our insurers, our professional indemnity insurers, will absolutely not allow us to give legal advice on social media. So be very careful. What's happened to me in a couple of times is when you're in one of these Clubhouse chat rooms and you're speaking, suddenly a non-lawyer will pop up from the audience and ask a question, which is really a question about legal a request for legal advice. You need to be very careful, and you cannot give it. So from the lawyer's perspective, social media is a brilliant replacement for our traditional business development activities, those lunches and so on and so forth, and it's not quite as calorific. Can we just go to the last paragraph, the last page? Sylvia touched upon this. We have a duty as lawyers to educate our clients. We've spoken about children, and what Sylvia said and what Charlotte said have international effect. But there are practical points, isn't there? You know, following a divorce, they should certainly change their social media passwords, etc. Consider new email and mobile accounts. you know, don't take photographs, including screenshots at court. You know, for example, when you're sitting in front of a judge on Zoom, etc., it's just not appropriate to post it on social media. Criticism of former spouses, well, that's self-evident, but it happens time and time and time again. It's not on the list here, but what I would say is this: there are a series of communication offences in England, criminal offences, and so on and so forth. In one such recent case, it's actually been held to be a criminal offence under the communications legislation for somebody to post a photoshopped photograph of their former spouse on social media. You know, it may actually be quite funny at one level, but it may be sinister on another level. And as I say, above all, respect your children's privacy. Now, a lot of what I've said is just common sense, but I do think we should all consider our individual and firm's social media strategies. It's a great way of bringing work in. It's a great way of maintaining contacts with family offices and whoever else sends work to you. I find it a brilliant way to get news of the Blue Book out. I had over 180 orders one day following, or Thomson Reuters had 180 orders just following a series of posts on LinkedIn and other social media platforms. So it does have an effect. Listen, thank you for bearing with me. And it's great to be a part of this marvelous panel. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed to James and to everybody else. We've got a couple of questions in one. So we have a question that has been answered already by Sylvia from Nigeria about monitoring children's digital communication. Is there a children's rights law in Germany? Because they have one in Nigeria. So there is no specific child rights law in Germany, but the German courts are saying this, it doesn't give parents the right to control each and every social media because the child's right of privacy has to be respected. So that's going quite far in terms of giving the child, sometimes quite young, quite a lot of control. Ivan Allegranti, who's joining us, Charlotte says the same for clients in Italy. I think when he says I 100% agree with Charlotte, it's becoming a big problem. I think that's probably the use of WhatsApp and clients WhatsApping you. And because in Italy now most don't apply a per hour invoice. Zosia, James, if you can put into the chat, please, how people can join the International Family Law Group on Sunday afternoon, that would be great. And then finally, a question from Derek, how do lawyers have time to maintain a decent social media presence? James, do you want to take that one?
Well, most lawyers are kind of sitting in their backsides in their bedrooms trying to, at the moment, they're not going out for lunches. They're not doing very much. Of course you've got time. Of course you've got time. I have a massively busy practice. I've recently emerged from a 10-day hearing. I've still managed to maintain my social media presence. The question is, can lawyers afford not to maintain their social media presence? And I suppose that depends on where your work comes from. If you have an international client base, you need to get out there. You need to be seen. You need to have a profile. So I really think, with all due respect, Derek, that's a nonsense question. Turning to your copy of the Blue Book, which hasn't arrived, it was only published, I think, two or three days ago. So I'm still waiting for mine as well. And I don't even think Charlotte's got hers, and they normally come to France first.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. So we are just on 10:20. So everyone will have an extra 5 minutes for their coffee to run to their kitchens or check their emails quickly. So thank you to Alison, Sylvia, Charlotte and James. Lots of food for thought for us. I think my new favourite social media story will be Alison's story of how the wife discovered the affair through the scales linking to Fitbit. That's definitely my new favourite social media story. And I think the as we all know, it's just beware, be careful. As we tell our clients, you know, every single thing that you send, message, always assume that a judge could look at it. So as we continue on our virtual journey, we will have a break now for 10 minutes and then Julie will take up the reins for the next panel session. Thank you to everybody, and I will hopefully see some of you at the networking lunch later on today. Thank you.